we get things underway here in the second hour of the program by welcoming in a singer, songwriter, and musician who's been making great music for more than 5 decades now.
Sun's up, looks okay, the world survives into another day, and I'm thinking about eternity.
He has had 12 Juno Awards in his career, has recorded over 30 albums. He's the author of a wonderful memoir, Rumors of Glory. We're pleased to be joined this afternoon by Bruce Coburn. Bruce, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Nice to talk to you.
How are you doing in this time of social isolation?
Doing okay. we're all dealing with the, you know, this new and exotic situation, but we're getting by all right.
Exotic. I like that.
Well, yeah, I mean, in the sense that it's not exotic in the pleasurable sense, but certainly in the sense of being something that's very different from how we've all expected our days to go in the past. So we're basically in the same boat as everybody else. And there are three of us, my wife and daughter and I, in our apartment in San Francisco, 24/7. So whereas there used to be space, my daughter would go to school and my wife goes to work and I do my thing through the day, and then we all can reconvene kind of at dinner time, but now it's all the time. So that's a pretty big change, and we're lucky enough to have a pretty decent sized apartment and in a neighborhood that's comfortable when we do go out. But it's still vastly more limited in scope than we're used to. So, although I have, as I hear myself saying that, I realize that we're also getting used to this now after this much time. But I'm not that happy about that, to be honest.
No.
I'd rather not be getting used to it.
In the midst of all this celebration of your work, box set, 50th anniversary box set. First of all, how amazing is it for an artist to be with the same label for 50 years? That's an incredible record of consistency.
You know, I mean, it is actually. I think it's relatively unusual. Maybe not quite unique. Perhaps it might be unique, but certainly rare in the music world that a relationship like that it persists for so long. But it's just worked. You know, so there's been never been any real reason to want to change it. It started because Bernie Finkelstein, who for most of those years was the owner of True North Records, wanted to start a record label, and I wanted to make an album, and our mutual friend Gene Martinek wanted to become a producer. We were all coming out of the sort of the band era of the 60s. Bernie had been a manager and Gene had been a guitar player in a couple of bands and I had also, but I had these songs that worked when I performed them solo better than any of the band stuff that I had done. And I wanted to kind of move forward with that. So with the three of us got together and True North Records started, and my first album was the first album on the label. Coming out in 1970, and it soon after, within the year, even after it came out, it was clear that I needed a manager. Bernie volunteered his services. Well, he didn't exactly volunteer. He suggested that I pay him to do that. And it seemed like a good arrangement, and we still have that arrangement. So aside from the oddness of having been with the same label all those years, I've had the same manager all those years also. And so that's kind of anomalous, let's say, in the music scene. But it's just, there's been, like I said, never any reason to really change it.
When did you start playing the guitar, Bruce?
I was 14. That would have been 1959. I was into rock and roll in a big way, and I really wanted to play guitar. I hadn't really formed the conscious intention, but I just had it as like, oh, it'd be so great to be able to do that. And then while a house we were, my dad was having built was, as things are generally and haven't changed, I mean, in this respect, the contractor was late on the thing. So the house wasn't ready when school started, and the old house, we'd moved out of the other place and blah, blah. So, we were staying at my grandmother's house for a couple of months, waiting for the new house to be finished. And I discovered in the attic, in a closet in the attic, this old beat up Hawaiian guitar. It was like, oh, this is meant to be. Here's a guitar that nobody cares about, and I get to have it. You know, so I painted gold stars on the top, and posed from in the mirror with it, and tried to play rock and roll riffs and without much success. And then, you know, but my parents could kind of see where this was going, and it's like, okay, look, if you want to take guitar lessons, or if you want to play the guitar, we will support that, but you have to promise to take lessons and learn to do it properly, and you have to promise that you won't grow sideburns and get a leather jacket. So I thought that was a fairly light burden. So I said, yeah, okay, let's do it. And so that's where it went.
You know, Bruce, this is Bruce. If you, you have 50 years with a record label, but you have established 50 years with a fan base that are very, very loyal. I'm one of those people who goes back, liked your music from the start. You've done something that I think maybe only Norman Blake and a few other guitar players have done, and that is for that long be both consistent as a songwriter and consistent as a writer of instrumentals. How do you approach the fact that you've been able to keep, you've been able to change, do different things, but you've kept this solid fan base? I think I know why, but I'm wondering what you think.
I think it's a blessing. I don't look at it too hard, but I'm grateful for it, and I'm very kind of proud of that element of my audience, that the people have been willing to hang in for that long. And through a bunch of changes too. I mean, I've tried to be the best I can be in musical terms and lyrical terms over those years. But in the course of that, there have been changes from, you know, in terms of musical style, in terms of the kind of direction that lyrics have gone, or that the kind of the content of songs has gone, and. Most of those people have stuck with me all that time. So it's, I'm like I say, very grateful for that.
Well, have the virtuosity on the fingerboard and that kind of a thoughtful, introspective way of making the lyrics fit the music and the playing. I learned from my friend Garnet Rogers that you also are a very good marksman. And I was wondering if those two things in your mind somehow work together. I, as a guitar player myself, I could start to see that when Garnet mentioned it the other day when we were chatting.
You know, I don't. I mean, it's interesting that he would say that, but to me, I didn't get involved in competitive shooting until till the very late '80s, and so it wasn't part of anything that happened before that. But I did discover sometime in the '80s, I can't remember exactly when, I lost most of the sight in my left eye because of a fungus infection that I picked up somewhere, and so I discovered that I'm left-handed, right? So anytime I had tried to do anything involving aim, throwing a ball, shooting a bow, shooting a gun, whatever it was, I could never hit anything, never get anything to go where I was playing darts, you know, whatever. I mean, I could never get anything to go where I wanted to. But when I lost the sight in the left eye, because I was assuming that because I was left-handed that I'd be aiming with that eye, I suddenly discovered that I'd been right-eyed all along. And that can happen. You can be left-handed and right-eyed and whatever. But So all of a sudden, I found that I could aim at things and hit them. And it sort of went from there. I discovered that a friend of mine who owned a guitar shop that I had frequented for years was into competitive pistol shooting. And you know, he said, well, why don't you come to the range one day and see what it's like? And that appealed to me for various reasons. And so I went with him. And sure enough, it was fun. And I just got further into it from there. So, and I spent maybe over a decade, 12 years-ish, quite deeply involved in competitive shooting. And then I haven't done it for years now, but that took me through sort of from the late 80s through into the 2000s doing that. And I got a lot out of it, actually, I think. And I don't know how much of a relationship there is between that and the creative side of what I do. I think it was exciting for me to discover, A, that I could hit something that I was aiming at, and B, that I actually liked competing when I felt like I could actually pull it off. I've never seen myself as a competitive person, and I've always avoided any kind of whiff of competitiveness that comes into the music scene, which it does, and not so much among the musicians, although it can be there, but more from the business side. It's like, well, you have to sell more records and so on. So what would you surely that person who started like 10 years after you shouldn't be getting more of an audience than you after all this time. And you hear this stuff from people. And I've always kind of resisted that way of thinking because it seems counterproductive and inappropriate to what I think music's all about. But I discovered that there was actually fun to be had on the level of a game like the shooting stuff in a competitive way. And so, you know, there was discoveries involved.
We're talking with Bruce Coburn here on Downtown. You've been an outspoken activist for your entire career. I heard somebody recently say what we're experiencing now with this COVID-19 pandemic could be a preview of coming attractions because we've failed, certainly here in the United States, we failed to properly address the issue of climate change.
Well, that failure is a pretty much a worldwide one. Some countries have made more meaningful gestures than others in the direction of addressing that, but most of us haven't. And you know, basically, we live in a world that is at the service of transnational corporations, global corporations. And I mean, it's not quite a feudal system. We're much better off than if it were that. But it's kind of, it's in a gentle way, kind of like that. So, you know, the aristocracy are these CEOs and the faceless stockholders, which is a lot of people. I mean, this is the difference between us and a real feudal system, is that a lot of average, quote-unquote, people own stock in these corporations and want to get paid on that, and expect to. But the fact is that is, I think, the biggest single factor in keeping everybody from addressing environmental issues or even from acknowledging there are such things. You know, because all that money plays a very strong propaganda game. For one thing, they can buy scientists, and they do, and they can buy politicians, and they do, and et cetera. You know, I mean, whether it's overt or just kind of a systemic relationship that exists between money and politics, et cetera, it works like that. So basically, nobody's doing enough, and we probably won't, because I don't see that system changing. Although it's taking a little bit of a hit right now with the virus going around and everything, but I don't think the hit is going to be big enough to actually change the system. I'm not sure what the system should be. I don't have an agenda that way, or I'm not promoting any particular set of ideas. I just think that it's pretty obvious that the way things that keeping on running things the way we have been is going to result in much bigger disasters than what we're currently looking at.
Bruce, we've enjoyed your music for many, many years and appreciate all you do using your platform to try and make the world a better place. We really appreciate you making time for us this afternoon and to wish you continued good health and success.
Well, thank you very much for that. And it's nice to spend the time with you.
Thank you again. Bruce Coburn with us here on Downtown.